Excuse me, recordings are started.
Thank you very much, operator. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the GNSS Council meeting on the 18th of April 2019. Would you please acknowledge your name when I call it out? Thank you. Pam Little.
Here.
Maxima Zilber.
Here.
Rubus Kuhl.
Here.
Keith Drazik.
Here.
Darcy Sudwell.
Here.
Michaela Nalen.
Here.
Carlos Gutierrez.
Here. Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you, Carlos. Marie Petullo.
Here. Yeah, thanks, Natalie.
Thanks, Marie. Scott McCormick has warned we'll be a couple of minutes late. Paul McGrady.
Here.
Philippe Foucault.
I'm here, thank you.
Thank you. Rafik Damak.
Here.
Thank you. And Elsa Saad is absent. Apologies for today's call. Arsene Tungali has also sent in his apologies, and we have Martin Silver-Valens assigned as his proxy. Philippe Pétillon. Philippe, you may be muted. I see you in the Adobe Connect room. Osvaldo Navoa.
Here, thank you.
Thank you. Tatiana Tropina.
Present. Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you, Tatiana. Martin Silver-Valent.
Present.
Aidan Fedeline.
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Said Marisha.
Yeah, here. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheryl Angonor.
Hey, thanks, Natalie.
Thank you. Erica Mann.
Natalie, yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Johan Selfingus.
Natalie.
Thank you. Martin Simon.
Hi, I'm here.
Thank you. And I'd like to welcome Simon. He's the CCNSO liaison to the GNSO Council, and this is his first GNSO Council meeting. So thank you very much, Martin. We'll also welcome today guest speakers from ICANN.org, Samad Hussein and Russ Weinstein. And from staff, we have apologies from Marika Koenigs. On the line, we have Steve Chan, Mary Wong, Julie Headland, Caitlin Chibigan, Barry Cobb, Errol Yang, Sarah Kaplis for technical support, Terry Agnew, myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please remember to state your name before speaking for recording purposes. Thank you, Keith, and over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Natalie. Hi, everybody. This is Keith Drazik. Welcome to the GNSO Council meeting of the 18th of April, 2019. So as I noted, prior to this meeting earlier in the day today, I sent an email, essentially a prep email or a summary of some of the key agenda items. Included in that email was a letter that I received from Manal of the GAC yesterday regarding the proposed motion that's before us today for the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Final Report recommendations. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody had a chance to review the contents of that email as well as the attachment. So if you haven't done so, please take an opportunity to do this as we're going through some of the administrative matters to begin the meeting. So with that, I will ask if there are any updates to statements of interest. If anybody updates your statement of interest, please raise your hand or speak up. Seeing no hands, we'll then move on to a review of the agenda. So the agenda is in front of us on the screen, and I think as most of you have probably seen, we've had already one request for moving one of the consent agenda items to the main agenda, which is the vote to approve the appointment of Yanis Karklins as the chair of the EPDP Phase 2. I received a request from Aidan on behalf of the NCSG to move that to the main agenda, which I'm happy to do. So we will have that separated out, but it does mean that we have to allow for time for a vote on the consent agenda as this additional, a separate vote on this particular topic. So in light of the amount of time that we have, and we have quite a full agenda today, and I expect there will be some discussion about the IGO-INGO CRP motion, I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on the action items when we get to that. We'll go through that fairly quickly and then get to the substance of the call. So review of the agenda. We have a few items on the consent agenda. Okay, so the first item on the consent agenda is a motion to adopt the GNSO Council response to the GAC communique. This was circulated with just before the call today. So what I'd like to do is to ask if there is anybody who feels that they need to have a longer opportunity to consider the substance of the GNSO Council response to the GAC communique. In those circumstances, what we would do is have an email vote following this meeting, because I'm just concerned that people haven't had a chance to either review the contents or the substance of the response and maybe not socialize it with their stakeholder groups and constituencies. So if anybody, and I see a hand up, I think, is that Pam? I can't read the entire thing on the Adobe Connect screen. No, it's Paul. Paul, go right ahead. Paul, if you're speaking, I can't hear you. You're Adobe.
Sorry about that. Yeah, there you've got to unmute two things, not one. This is Paul McGrady for the record. Did it change again after we reverted Pam's language this morning? Or is it that version?
I'm going to defer to Yolf on this one. Yolf, if you could speak to this as the coordinator of the effort to develop the GNSO Council response, if you could speak to where we are with this and where the latest draft ended up, please. Hey, Yul, can you join?
Oh, sorry. Same thing again. Two different mutes. Sorry.
Thank you.
So this is Yul for recording. Thanks, Keith. Yes, it is my understanding that it is as it was this morning. We reverted the last change. So it is unchanged from this morning.
Okay. So Paul says thanks. So again, I'll ask, would anybody like to remove this from the consent agenda, or shall we leave it on the consent agenda? Going once, going twice. All right, it will remain on the consent agenda. Thank you. So again, just reviewing the agenda at this time, we have also a confirmation. This is on the consent agenda, confirmation of the recommendations report to the board regarding the final report from phase one of the EPDP. This is a procedural confirmation of the recommendations report by council. As I noted, the previous third bullet under the consent agenda has now been moved. That's regarding the appointment of Yanis Karklins as chair of phase two. And then finally on the consent agenda is the approval of the suggested amendments to the GNSO's fellowship selection criteria. And this is the effort that Heather Forrest was helping to coordinate for us. So that will be then three items on the consent agenda. Then moving down to the main agenda, we will have the discussion and then council vote on the appointment, the approval of the appointment of Yanis Karklins as chair for the EPDP phase two. On item number five, we will have a council vote, a council discussion and vote on the IGO-INGO access to curative rights motion before us. Then have a council discussion on managing IDN variant TLDs. There's 15 minutes allocated to that, and that's the session that Saad Hussein from ICANN.org will lead. Then we'll have a council update on the status of the EPDP Phase 1 implementation and implementation review team. Then we will have council discussion on an updated timeline for the PDP on all rights bring mechanisms. And then any other business. So are there any suggested edits or additions to our agenda today? As I noted, that's a pretty full agenda with some, you know, some pretty substantive topics. Okay, not seeing any hands. And let's go back to a quick review of the action items list. So if we could please have the action items put on the screen. And while we're doing that, let me just note that I'll just start going through them. The first item on the action item list is a reference to the election timeline with regard to travel guidelines for ICANN-funded travelers. I sent an email to the stakeholder group chairs and constituency chairs about this issue, but it's basically to highlight that ICANN travel funding has changed its guidelines from 90 days to 120 days, and that this could potentially have an impact on new officers or new folks elected to positions prior to the annual global meeting. So, in other words, if you haven't, if you are elected and appointed, but it's after the 120-day prior notice requirement for ICANN travel, appointed member would be ineligible for ICANN travel funding because they would have missed 120 days. And the email I sent was essentially highlighting this for the chairs of stakeholder groups and constituencies to make sure that each group is updating its charter or is at least aware of the situation as we head into election season. Would anybody like to speak to this before I move on? Okay, seeing no hands. On the action item list are a reference to the IRTP policy status report and the privacy proxy service accreditation issues. That's the PPSAI. So I think at least on the PPSAI, Pam, I know that you have been helping to coordinate a draft letter and in response to the letter that we received as counsel from ICANN.org asking for the council's views on the pause and the possible restart of the PPSAI effort. So if I could have you speak to that one, and then if there's anything else about the IRTP policy status report that we should touch on briefly right now, and either you or Darcy can speak to that. Pam?
Thank you, Keith. Pam Little for the record. So we have had some discussion on the mailing list, so I think I would just touch upon the first part of that draft letter, which concerns whether the pause of the PPSAI, i.e. the implementation work, should continue. So as everyone will recall, in Kobe, we discussed this during our council meeting, and there are different views among the councillors. So the goal of this letter really is to reconcile those views and see whether we can find common ground and the next step to see how this work can proceed. So that was really the purpose of that letter, to record and recognize there are different views among the councillors. And the latest suggestion or suggested edits from the IPC I was responding to only yesterday, and I apologize for only responding so late, was I feel there's we also have another stream of work that is the vehicle for us to respond to GAC advice, and this topic is also included in the Kobe GAC communique. And we have the small team there drafting. I believe Paul McGrady, our colleague from the IPC, is also in that small team. I feel quite strongly that the suggested added additional language of noting the GAC advice on these should be dealt with in the council's review of the GAC communique. So that's part one. The other part was about, you know, our different views whether the IRT implementation should continue or should continue should kick start again or continue the pause. I guess Philip or IPC colleagues and the registrar representatives on the council really would I can only say agree to disagree. Can you hear me? Yeah. So the final report of that policy or policy recommendation was over 3.5 years ago, and the council approved or adopted the final report or those recommendations over 3 years ago. And a lot has happened since then, as everyone in this call would recognize. So we are reviewing a lot of the ICANN policies that are affected. So I am not as confident as my IPC colleagues who feel there's no need to review those policies, and those policy recommendations are all sound from the final report. So I guess we have different views on that. The other bit on the transfer, the referral of the transfer issue to the IRT, I believe the letter is pretty self-explanatory. If anyone has any question about that, or I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Pam. This is Keith. I think Paul McGrady has noted in the chat that FLIP is working this particular issue on behalf of the IPC, and I know that there's been an exchange just over the last 12 to 24 hours on this topic. Thank you for taking the lead on helping to coordinate this, and I'm confident that over the next couple of days that we'll be able to come to a letter that we can all agree to and that we will send in response to Cyrus. So obviously, this is it's a challenging issue, and there are differences of opinion among councillors. But I think the goal, as you noted, is for the letter to capture that and to respond in a meaningful way to Cyrus and the request that we received. Flip, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Thank you, Keith. Flip, for the record. I just want to be very brief and refer to the email so I don't repeat myself or what is in the email. I just want to be very consistent. And I expressly referred to what the EBDP itself has actually said about this issue. And I think we should take that into account. We should give it thorough consideration before we move on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Flip, and thank you, Pam. So in the interest of time, we'll move on and just note that there's ongoing and active work on this particular topic, which is why I wanted to highlight it today for everybody, and that in the near future, we will be finalizing that document and responding to Cyrus with as best a position we can take, even recognizing that there are differences of opinion on a couple of different sides of this. So, okay, so let's move on. And then I guess I had just a question for anybody. IRTP. Policy status report, and I don't know, Darcy, if you've been following this one, or Pam, if there's any update that we need to discuss today on that one.
Okay.
Yeah, Pam, go ahead.
Sorry. I believe we are waiting for ICANN staff to provide the council with the updated status report prepared by staff. So no action at the moment. I think there are quite a few moving parts at the moment. We have that report or final report from staff. Also, there's EPDP, the work stemmed from the EPDP phase one to review the transfer policy. So I think maybe in the next meeting, the council can discuss how to move that forward. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Pam. So we'll put that as an action item for the next meeting. Okay. I'm just reviewing the action items. And I think that I think this is pretty straightforward. I don't think there's anything that we need to call out at this point in light of the other things that we need to get to today. I want to just take this moment, though. I heard Erica say that she had to drop, and the CCWG on auction proceeds is one of the items on the action list. So Erica, if you're still there, if there's any update you'd like to provide on auction proceeds CCWG, feel free to do so.
I'm still here, just checking if you can hear me.
We sure can. Thank you.
Wonderful, Keith. No, there is no real update. We at our last meeting in Kobe, I mentioned that I would love to have a longer session in Marrakesh. We would love to make real progress. It's very difficult to have these calls only, on the phone, with the few exceptions which we had in the past in real meetings, and then we always had very short meeting. We are at the end phase, so we are reviewing the public comments we received. It's a very technical work where it helps immensely if one just can sit down and can go through the comments quickly. We have great templates. Staff is working immensely hard to prepare everything, but you can imagine one loses a lot of time, just because it takes time to get in the, in the rhythm of reviewing these comments. And it's just that people need to be constantly reminded, members as well, where we are and what we're talking about. And it's much, much easier and goes faster if we can do this online. We agreed that we will have the, we're not planning to finalize it in Marrakesh, but we want to have a, let's say practically in diplomatic terms, you would call it a zero paper ahead of Marrakesh. And then we like to review this zero document, and then we will give us still 1 month or maybe 2 months to finalize it after Marrakesh. That's the goal. So it's a very tight calendar. I'm not going into the topics. I don't think it would make sense to discuss this on the call today. Is this okay, Keith?
Thank you, Erica. That's perfect. And that's a good brief update for everybody. And I'm sure as there are other developments, you'll bring them to our attention. And if anybody has questions,
absolutely,
Erica, feel free to reach out directly.
Keith, absolutely. I will stay silent and will not send anything if there's not a major conflict or a major development which is not coherent to what I said today or what I said in Kobe. Otherwise, you will hear from me.
Very good. Thank you so much, Erica.
Pleasure.
And we understand that you'll need to drop shortly for boarding a flight. So thank you.
It will be disrupted, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is park the rest of the action items, and if we have time at the end of the meeting, we can come back to them. I think we covered sort of the key topics that are sort of active at the moment. So with that, let us move then to the next part of our agenda, which is the consent agenda. So as I noted, we have three items on the consent agenda for now. First is the motion to adopt the GNSO Council response to the GECT communique. The second is the confirmation of the recommendations report to the board on phase one, the EPDP phase one final report. And the third is approval of the suggested amendments to the GNSO's fellowship selection criteria. So with that, Natalie, if I could hand it over to you, please.
Thank you very much, Keith. Would anyone like to abstain from this motion? Please say aye. Hearing no one, would anyone like to vote against this motion? Please say aye. Hearing none, would all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. Martin Solovalent and Aidan Fedeline, world proxies, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much. With no abstention, no objection, the motion passes, Keith.
Natalie, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Natalie, this is Terry. I can hear you.
I don't hear Natalie in Adobe Connect.
I can hear Natalie in the bridge.
Yeah, I can.
Oh,
I hear you.
Can you hear me now? This might be the Adobe Connect audio failing.
So Rafiq and I cannot hear Natalie on the AC.
Can you hear me?
Natalie, Cheryl here. We went through this several times in Adobe Connect.
Keith, this is Mary from staff. We'll just double-check and give us a second. Sorry.
Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it. And if I need the dial.
The phone bridge stays up and the audio into the AC crashed. I think it happens at least three times on a call I was on yesterday. So if it's starting to happen, you're really going to have an issue today with such a busy agenda.
Okay, just in case the AC audio does come back, I'll just carry on speaking. Keith, can you hear me? As a reminder, for recording purposes, we all need to be on the audio bridge. That's where the recordings take place, the transcript equally. So if we are going to have Adobe Connect audio
as well. I see you're typing into chat. I think some of us can be heard on AC and others not. The app is trying to resolve. If you can hear me or not.
Meet everyone. This is Mary from staff again. And a reminder to everyone that it's best if you join on the audio bridge because AC audio is not the most reliable. And so, Keith, while everyone does that, would you want to hold on the results of this onto the next item in the interest of time?
Mary, this is thank you. I think what we need to do is to make sure that everybody's on and able to hear. So if that means we need to take 2 minutes and everybody try to join the phone bridge, then maybe we need to do that. So let's just give it another minute here and see if. Everybody, let's do this. Let's take 5 minutes and everybody join the phone bridge. If anybody needs a dial out, please type it into the Adobe chat room.
Hi, everyone. This is Terry. I did reconnect the Adobe Connect line. For those only on Adobe Connect, can you verify if you're able to hear me? Again, only those that did not connect via the telephone.
Terry, this is Mary. I'm still on AC and I can hear you, but hopefully the counselors are dialing in themselves as well.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. This is Natalie on the audio bridge. Please let me know if you need to dial out.
I'm hearing perfect. I don't know if anybody is speaking also.
I think it was just me for the moment on the audio bridge.
Oh,
hi, this is Keith. I'm back here on the phone bridge now.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Keith, we're just dialing out to you, so if you just wait a couple of seconds, and we'll let you know when he's joined.
All right. Thanks, Natalie.
Martin, no one was speaking. This is Natalie. Can you hear me? Tatiana's point in the reconnecting chat, please remember to mute your phones when you join the phone bridge. Thank you. Keith, this is Natalie. We're just waiting on Yolf to join. Just out of interest for those on the Adobe Connect room, when did the audio cut out for you? Was it at the result of the consent agenda vote or when I called out the proxies?
Natalie, this is Keith. I don't believe we heard you call out the proxies. So I think it was we had basically gotten through your call for abstentions, no votes, yes votes, and then that was it.
Okay, perfect. We'll pick it up then. Keith, this is Natalie. Yolf has joined us on the phone. Is it okay if I just start again at the proxy vote and announce the results?
Yes, please, Natalie. And thanks, everybody, for your patience here. I trust everybody is back and can hear. Thank you, Natalie. Yes, let's go ahead and complete the voting on the consent agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, to date, there were no abstentions, no objections on the consent agenda vote. Martin Silva-Valent and Aidan Federline, who holds proxies, please state your vote.
Aye.
I believe we're missing Martin,
perfect.
Unless I misheard. Martin Silva-Valent, you hold a proxy for Arsene Singali. Please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much. With no abstention, no objection, the motion passes, Keith.
Great. Very good. Thank you very much, Natalie, and thanks, everybody, for your votes and for your patience in terms of our technical difficulties. So we will then move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the discussion and the council vote for the approval of the appointment of Yannis Karkmans as chair for the EPDP Phase 2. So I'll just, again, summarize and remind everybody that the GNSO Council has a process. It was the same process that we used for the appointment of Kurt Pritz as the Phase 1 chair, where we issued a statement, a call for expressions of interest. The GNSO Council leadership team, myself, Rafiq, and Pam, as well as the leadership team for the Standing Selection Committee, went through a process of review of the expressions of interest and had a discussion and agreed unanimously to recommend the appointment of Yannis Karkmans, one of the two respondents to the expression of interest call. And so before us today, we have a vote for the appointment of Yanis Karklund as chair for phase two, but we did receive, as I noted earlier, a request from Aiden and the MCSG to have this moved to the main agenda so we could have a discussion. So Aiden, would you like to pick this one up or someone else? Aiden, thank you.
I would. Thanks very much, Steve. Hi, everyone. This is Aiden. And just before I begin, and just to alleviate some concerns, because I know we all want the ETDP to resume as soon as possible, the MCSG is going to cast our votes in favor of this candidate, so don't worry about that. It is more a process note and a question that we wanted to raise. And really, I have one question, one statement, and one suggestion that I wanted to put forward that might possibly alleviate some of the concerns that I have and others in the MCSG have, and which are probably going to be embedded within my question. So initially, when I saw this motion on the agenda, I felt like we were being asked to rubber stamp one name to serve as the EPDP chair. And I appreciate that we need a chair urgently, and the candidate before us is very qualified. I don't question that, and no one in the MCSG questions that. However, on a process note, I was surprised to see that an email had been sent to one candidate rejecting him, and another email was sent to the other candidate saying he was a preferred pick before we even casted our votes today. And so what's done is done, but in the future, I would just suggest that we send both candidates an update saying this is the motion that council is considering, and only sending notices of rejection to candidates once we have the consensus decision on who should be the chair. And this is something that I very much hope we can do in the future. On the substance of the agenda item before us, from what I understand, the candidate that we are being asked to appoint as EPDP chair is also the chair of the General Assembly of the World Intellectual Property Organization. And this, to me, raises significant questions about his impartiality. He also has a long history with the GAC, and to the best of my knowledge, not significant experience of engaging in GNSO procedures, which are not quite the same as those which the GAC operates under. So I would find it very helpful to hear from council leadership as to whether this factor that he is chair of WIPO's General Assembly, whether that was something that was considered in his appointment, whether it was viewed by any members of council leadership or the Standing Selection Committee leadership team as problematic. I just feel a little in the dark as to how the candidates were actually assessed, what factors went into recommending one over the other. Because when I try to be objective here and I look at both candidates, I see in one, the rejected candidate, a trained neutral lawyer and mediator, and I would have thought that these were very desirable skills in an EPDB chair. And then I see another candidate who I would think is, again, very, very qualified and does have experience in other parts of the ICANN community, however, is also involved in a different capacity in what I would say is a role that could potentially be supporting the particular stakeholder group. And I guess that's what leads me to put forward the suggestion, and something that I raised very briefly on our list today. Can't we retain Chris as well? Can't he serve as a co-chair or as, at the very least, as vice chair? And because what I see before us are two qualified candidates. We have a shortage of people who are willing to chair these working groups. So why not accept both and have them divvy up the work as they see fit? Thanks.
Thanks, Aiden. This is Keith, and I see Tatiana's in queue, but let me try to respond to the last point that you made about the vice chair or co-chair situation. I think the current situation is obviously that we had, for phase one, we had appointed Kurt Pritz as the GNSO Council appointed chair. And there was then follow-on discussion about the need for a vice chair to be selected from among the group. And it turned out that individuals representing the various stakeholder groups and constituencies, SOs, ACs, felt they didn't want to assign somebody to a neutral leadership position because it would take away one of their people from participating as an advocate. And so Rafiq, as the GNSO Council liaison, was also appointed to be vice chair. I believe I recall Rafiq mentioning in our meetings in Kobe, and Rafiq, I'll certainly welcome your input on this, is that there was a recognition that, you know, we might need to revisit the role of the vice chair and the occupant of the vice chair role, noting that we have, you know, sort of Rafiq wearing two hats at the moment. And so I think there is an opportunity for us to review the vice chair situation. But in order to have a co-chair, we would actually have to reopen the charter for the EPDP. And I think at this point, I think having, you know, a single chair able to make decisions, finding consensus among the group is probably the preferred way to go. I'll speak frankly here, and I think, you know, we're seeing some challenges related to a co-chairing situation in the RPM PDP working group. And I'm not sure that we want to necessarily go down the path of having co-chairs at this point. At least my feeling is probably not. But I'm certainly open to further discussion on the vice chair issue. I'll have to go back and check, Aidan, on your earlier question about the relationship with WIPO. I know that Janis Karklins is the current Latvian ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, but I'll have to go back and double check on the question you raised related to the WIPO situation. So with that, we can come back and have further conversation about that. But Tatiana, over to you.
Thank you very much, Keith. Tatiana, first of all, I want to echo Aidan's concerns about connection of the proposed chair to WIPO. This is open information. One can find it online. And I do wonder if GNSO leadership and Standing Selection Committee leadership addressed this issue, because I think that it just, you know, it screams for a possible conflict of interest, and I really wanted a clarification on this. Don't get me wrong, I don't want to block this chair. I don't want to vote against him. I don't want to stop the process. I understand that on EPDP we need to restart as soon as possible with someone who can lead, but I do want a bit of clarity whether this was in his application, where this issue was addressed, whether GNSO leadership saw any link to possible conflict of interest. So I do think that this is a big issue here, because finally it does relate. I'm sure that this chair, prospective chair, suggested chair, is very capable. But how do we ensure neutrality, and whether this issue was addressed during the conversation? And secondly, about Chris and co-chairing and vice-chairing. There was a big conversation in Kobe, I think on the GNSO Council and on the EPDP itself, about resources. We talked about a different timing for transcript, for example, for supplying of transcripts. We compromised on this. But if you remember, for the EPDP phase one, I believe that we used professional mediator. And what strikes me here is that the person who is professional mediator is actually willing to serve as a chair or co-chair free of charge. And why don't we can find a way why cannot we find a way to utilize this somehow is a bit beyond me. So I believe that maybe it would be good to revisit this. And I'm not talking about opening the charter. I would be very much against this. But I would like to have another careful look at the charter and see if it actually opened the room for co-chair. And I understand that maybe many would be against this. But using Chris, maybe in any other capacity where he can serve, because he's willing to serve, I believe might help us, because he's a mediator and we paid to them. So basically, this is it. Thank you.
So, thanks, Tatiana. This is Keith. Just a couple of responses there, and then I'll circle back to Aidan's question about the WIPO connection. I actually had the same thought, is that at some point, if it turns out that the group needs additional resources and, you know, mediation support or something along the lines of, you know, the services and the expertise that Chris has, then that's certainly something we could consider down the road as it relates to, we have already identified to ICANN org and the board that we would like to continue having the facilitators, that we continue to need the legal expertise in the phase two work. But we also made it clear that this was a preliminary list of resources that we were requesting, and that it would be, you know, once the new chair was appointed and the and essentially the group was able to start its work on phase two, that we might come back for other requests. So I certainly wouldn't close the door on that possibility at all. I think that's certainly within the purview of the new chair and the group once it gets going in phase two, and something that should be considered. Let me circle back now to Aiden's question about the connection, and Tatiana reinforced it with WIPO, and that yes, Yanis did include that in his application, that he was the chair of the WIPO General Assembly, either acting chair or current chair, one of the two. And so that was in his application, and during the discussions of the leadership team, it was not identified as a, you know, a strong concern or a conflict. And so I guess I'm curious if you all would like to talk a little bit more about what you think the conflict is or might be. But I think at the end of the day, you know, any chair of any group is likely to, you know, come from a part of our community and to, you know, have a range of interests. And but they're still required to and expected to act in a neutral and even-handed fashion. Kurt, in phase one, was, he's currently associated with a new GTLD registry operator, and he participates in the registry stakeholder group. And so I think for us to think that, you know, chairs of groups, while expected to be neutral, don't have, you know, connections to other parts of the community is really, really a challenge. I just think that's a tall order. I see Maxime and then Pam.
Maxime Alzobin for the transcript. Do you hear me?
Yes, Maxime, go right ahead.
I would like to add some items to discussion about the chair for EPDP. In addition to experience, we have to take into account the historical experience of the community. I hope I'm not mistaken, Chris Lahate held post of ombudsman by the time of the previous Marrakech meeting. And there were concerns in the community from the parties who had interaction about the process and outcome. And without taking into account the opinion of the community, we shouldn't say, yes, the person was trained, but we shouldn't forget about the historical experience of the results of when the training was applied to the life field. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxime. Pam and then Paul, and then we need to move on.
Pam Little speaking. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Pam.
Thanks, Keith. I just want to maybe respond to Aiden's question. The leadership of the GNSF Council and the Standing Selection Committee did discuss the issue of potential conflict, but we, as Keith mentioned, did not see this as a material issue in terms of Yana's association with various organizations or his previous role as the GAC chair. I want to echo the view that, as Keith said, in the ICANN land, it is a very, very small world. and we often have our commercial background or interests we're representing or different organization we're representing. So it is very difficult to say we all perfectly neutral. So I guess the issue with the potential conflict interest really is really for those to feel that that there is such perceived or actual conflict of interest to articulate better what they are. And then it is also up to the council and the EPDP team to really make sure the new chair is acting in a neutral manner, as required under the charter, as required under the GNSO operating procedure. It is very clear. And we now also have the PDP 3.0 to really take a more proactive role in sort of, I guess, keep an eye on how a team or working group chairs is performing or not performing. So I guess that's something up to us to make sure the new chair is fully aware of the importance to act in a neutral manner when he's onboarded, and also going forward to make sure that is the case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Pam.
Okay.
Paul, you're next. Maxime, I think that's an old hand, if I'm not mistaken. Paul, you're next, and then we'll go to any last words on this, and then we'll move to the vote. Thanks.
Thanks, Keith. This is Paul McGrady for the record. Going back to Aiden's idea about Chris, do you think it makes sense to put the question to the EPDP team, you know, how can Chris best help, and let them know that reopening the charter isn't our favorite thing, but, you know, maybe finding a way for Chris to, you know, from the earliest days of phase two, to be involved in problem solving, to be involved in ideation, to get past roadblocks, you know, that kind of thing. I think we've got a gem in Chris. I think that the folks who chose the other guy made the right choice, but I think Chris is great. And I don't want us to get too wrapped up in the, you know, was he with WIPO discussion and miss the opportunity to latch on to what Aiden suggested about getting Chris involved. So I don't know what we do with it next. Is it a council thing? Is it a ask the EPDP team thing? Is it a ponder it and talk about it again on the next call thing? I just don't want us to lose it. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks to Aiden and Tatiana and everybody for weighing in on this. I think, you know, at this point, I think, frankly, that we should give the new chair the opportunity to get the team going, get the work started, and get things going. And then if it appears that we need some assistance in mediation or something like that, then it's completely logical, I think, that at that point the EPDP team and chair would basically identify an additional resource request, and the council could then follow through on that. So, again, I'm happy to continue the discussion, but I think at this point we should be, you know, we should be focused on, you know, supporting the new chair to the utmost, and to basically give the group the opportunity to get started. And frankly, if there are concerns about neutrality or lack of neutrality, then those are the kinds of things that should be escalated up from the EPDP team through the GNSO council liaison to us, and then we can review, you know, how best to handle that and how best to deal with it. I don't think that's going to be a problem. If I thought that would be a problem, we wouldn't have recommended Giannis as the person. But I think let's not close any doors at this point, but I think I'd like to, you know, give the new chair the opportunity, you know, to get things going. So, and I just want to also just the emails that I sent, Aiden, this is in response to one of your points. The emails that I sent to both Giannis and to Chris Lahat didn't say that the decision had been made by council. It said that the recommendation had been made by the leadership team and the SSC leadership team, and that the council would be, you know, essentially taking it on during our meeting today. So it wasn't a complete rejection at that point. It was essentially, you know, we followed the process, and the process is the recommendation has been made to the full council. So with that, any final thoughts before we move to a vote? Okay. Thanks, everybody, for that. And let's, Natalie, I will hand this one over to you for a vote.
Thank you very much, Keith. Would anyone like to abstain from this motion? Please say aye. Hearing no one, would anyone like to vote against this motion? Hearing none, would all those in favor of the motion please say aye.
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 Martin Silvervalent and Aidan Fidelin, who hold proxies, please say aye.
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 Thank you very much. With no abstention, no objection, the motion passes. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Appreciate that. And thanks to all for the good discussion. Agree with Paul and Aidan in the chat. It was worthy to have the discussion. So thanks for bringing that up, and glad to move that one from consent to the main agenda so we can do that. Okay, let's then move to the next item on our agenda, item number 5, which is the council vote, discussion and vote on the IGO-INGO access to curative rights protection mechanisms. So this is not new to anyone, obviously. We have been discussing this for what seems like an eternity, and certainly for the last 10 months, I believe, since the final report was delivered by the PDP working group itself. And the motion before us, essentially, as I summarized and explained in the email I sent to the council list earlier, as well as before us and the motion language, basically is a recommendation to for the council to approve the first 4 recommendations and forward those to the board, and for the 5th recommendation to refer it, so to reject it and to refer the topic for further work under the RPM PDP working group. And I understand that there are some concerns about, you know, what that might do and how that might impact the work of the RPM PDP. But I would like for us to consider that as we look to potentially recharter the phase 2 work or the RPM PDP working group generally, that we consider this as a possible subteam or a separate work track concentrated folks with expertise who can actually, you know, focus on the issue. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the RPM PDP working group as a whole. We could consider it as a work track 5-like effort associated with subsequent procedures group, as an example. Or it could be, a subgroup could be chartered by the council under some of our PDP 3.0 sort of guidelines. So I just want to – that's essentially what the recommendation is. It's not any or much different than what the council leadership proposed back in December. We've had, endless discussions about this, and I think this is, an opportunity for us to move this thing forward, to acknowledge that some of us think that the right thing to do is to approve everything and forward it to the board and let them deal with it. Others of us feel like we should reject everything and start over. And I feel like this is a middle ground or a compromise position that acknowledges that the group reached consensus on the first 4 recommendations. Recommendation number 5 was out of scope and is specifically a recommendation related to the UDRP. And therefore, sort of sending this to them, to the RPM PDP working group, gives the opportunity for further work on the topic before approving, a policy that in this particular case would have actually made things worse for the IGOs and was certainly out of scope for the work of the IGO-INGO CRP work. So I'm just going to pause there and see if there's any further thoughts or discussion on this from anybody. I also should note, again, that we received a letter from Manal, GAC chair, yesterday. I had sent her a courtesy note to let her know that following, the engagement that we had in Kobe and before, that this was the direction that the council was taking, at least that this was going to be the motion put before council for a vote. And the letter that I received back yesterday was pretty clear in that it was, expressed some surprise and expressed disappointment that this was the direction that we were going. I think the GAC would clearly prefer to have a standalone EPDP on the issue without the council approving any of the first four recommendations to basically start the work over with an EPDP. And so that's out there. I think we need to recognize that, that the path that we're taking is still not consistent with GAC advice. That could, present the situation with the board where the board decides to take a different action than what we're recommending. And so I think there's still, a fair amount of uncertainty about how this actually plays out in the end. But let me pause there. So I see Paul and Martin. Paul, go right ahead.
Thanks. Paul McGrady here. So I have a really dumb procedural question, which is, so if this is, we don't reach, assume for a moment we don't reach enough votes to vote yes on this. Resolved one, the GENISO Council approves, we don't vote yes, so those are clearly disapproved. Number two relates to recommendation number five, where we say we do not approve, but if we vote no, then we do not approve the not approval, therefore recommendation five is approved, or therefore nothing happens with recommendation number five and it just sits there, being neither approved or disapproved. How does that work? Thank you. Staff?
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Paul. So I will turn to either Natalie or Mary to help out with this answer. My sense is that it's, we're voting on a single motion, and therefore it's approved or it's not approved. What that means is a good question. So I don't know, Natalie or Mary, do you have Mary? Go right ahead. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Keith. And Paul, I hope I understood your question correctly. My other colleagues can jump in and rescue me if I get anything messed up. But I think there's two points here. One is the more substantive point you raised, Paul, as in if you vote to approve recommendations 1 through 4, which is the first resolve clause, but you don't vote to affirmatively approve recommendation 5, what does that mean? Does recommendation 5 just hang out there? The staff answer for now is that, yes, that is indeed the case, because the motion is worded in such a way that you are affirmatively approving recommendations 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so if there is no vote to approve recommendation 5, it just isn't approved. On the second question, which Keith touched on, about voting as a package, one difference between this motion and the typical PDP motion, which basically just says all the recommendations together, in that latter case, the council is normally discouraged from unpacking the different recommendations. In this particular case, you are looking at two different votes, if you like. So I would say that if, for example, the council, in terms of recommendation 5, would like to vote on a different mechanism, for example, and assuming that that can be a friendly amendment, then you could certainly alter that resolve clause 2 and anyone that follows on the mechanism. In other words, there's nothing to prevent you from, first of all, approving recommendations 1 through 4 and deciding how you want to deal with recommendation 5. I hope that's clear. Thank you, Keith.
Okay, thank you, Mary. And Paul, I don't know if you have any follow-up, if you could go right ahead. Yeah,
thanks, Keith. So, I'm not sure that Mary understood my question, because my question did not anticipate breaking these things up. There was some talk about breaking the various chunks of motions up during the phase one EPDP vote, and I thought the takeaway from that was we don't do that. And so I'm a little concerned to start doing it if we, don't always do it, right? So one, I want to make sure that the vote is unitary, up or down on the whole thing. And then I'll do better with my question, which is question number two, which is if it's a unitary vote and the collective vote is no, then 1 through 4 die because they're not approved. What happens to number 5? We don't accidentally approve it by voting no to disapprove it, right? Thanks.
Mary, go ahead.
Thanks, Keith, and thanks, Paul. And I apologize that I didn't quite get that right. But just to keep matters brief, yes, if you vote this motion as a unitary motion, and if the motion fails, nothing gets approved. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Mary.
Yep, thanks, Mary, and thanks, Paul, for the question. Carlos, you're next.
Thank you very much, Keith. This is Carlos for the record. I just want to praise, to come with a single resolution. Nevertheless, I understand the disappointment from the GAC side. In a very specific perspective, every time we have discussed this, we have a track record with a different solution, which was the protection for the Red Cross and Red Crescent, which was a very simple list to protect 190 countries. It amounts to a few thousand names, and everybody was happy. And here we are lost in a totally different mechanism, and saying we don't need a new right protection mechanism might have not been explained well enough to the GAC community. So I don't feel good about this choice of that we have in front of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlos. This is Keith for the transcript. Look, this has been a challenging one from the beginning, and we have a range of views, as I said in my email, and as I've said before, on council. And we have strongly held views that we should approve everything and kick it to the board and let the board deal with it. We have strongly held views that everything should be rejected and we should start from scratch. And I think this, while imperfect, and I understand the disappointment and the feelings of the GAC members, and particularly the IGOs in this. But we're in a situation where we have to follow our procedures. There was a consensus set of recommendations that came from that group, and we're in a situation now where I think we've recognized that one of the five recommendations had serious problems, was out of scope, and recommended changes to a consensus policy that is currently or about to be under review by the RPM PDP working group. And so I think we're trying to do the best we can under these difficult circumstances. And it's, there is no perfect solution to this one. So I understand, I hear you, and perhaps what we as the GNSO Council can consider if and when we refer this to the RPM group, is to give it some level of priority, give it some level very, very narrowly focused charter to keep it on track, to ensure that there are experts available to participate in the group. And we've talked about referring it to phase two, but if we're looking at possibly, setting up a chartered sub-team of dedicated focus under the group, under the RPM group, maybe it doesn't have to wait until phase two. Maybe it can begin sooner. Like, I think there's a range of options that we as council can consider here, relying on PDP 3.0, and to, make sure that it doesn't just get kicked down the road for 2 years. I think we're at a point now where we have to make a decision. We have to make a decision, and at some point, the board may decide that it's not going to accept our recommendations, and it may kick them back to us. And if they do, we'll deal with that. But that's sort of where my head is at right now. So, Paul, I think that was an old hand, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to go to Tatiana next, and if anybody else would like to get in queue, please do.
Thank you, Keith. Tatiana Trupini speaking briefly. While I do understand Carlos' concerns and anyone else's concerns who say that GAC is unhappy and we shouldn't do it because we will have conflicting GAC advice to the board, but I would like to say that, first of all,
we are GNSO and we have our own process for policy development. We cannot, I mean, I do understand the willingness and the desire to make everyone happy, but at the end, I do not believe that in this case it would be possible unless we admit fully cave to God. And this I wouldn't like us to do. As far as I remember from the timeline, you know, in Barcelona, until the GAC advice break, and we were discussing that we might vote for the entire package of recommendation. Now we're trying to find a compromise. And this decision to compromise is already trying to make at least, you know, kind of, okay, GAC will not be happy, but still we are trying to compromise and not approve them all. And I do believe, as Keith said, that I can vote and I can has a process for the board to do so policy and GAC advice. But I do believe that we have to get at least something done here. I do believe that we express several times, some of us, that let's just vote for the entire package. For me, not voting for number 5 is already a compromise. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tatiana. Philip?
Thank you, Keith. For the record, yes, I understand that we're caught between a rock and a hard place. This is probably the least unsatisfactory decision for this, and we have to make a decision. I understand GAC frustration on this. The only thing is that I'd like to make sure that we keep council in our role of the manager of the PDP, and it's not council revising the substance. So I understand that, and it's now a question. The rationale for not approving recommendation 5 is that it's out of scope. I'd like to have that on the record. I didn't read that quite specifically in the motion. Maybe it's just my reading of this, but I wouldn't like this to be a precedent for future decisions. So I just want to have that clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. This is Keith again. I think the sense is, and the view is, that recommendation number 5 was out of scope, in that the group was tasked to just try to decide if a new or separate process should be developed or put in place to accommodate IGOs, and instead recommendation 5 actually recommends a change to the UDRP that would make things worse for IGOs rather than providing them something that's better or different. And so I think, you know, the sense is that in addition to it recommending a change to an existing consensus policy where there's other policy work already chartered to focus on that, that in effect was out of scope for what the group should have been focusing on. And that's the rationale for essentially not opening up and not changing the substance at the council level, because I agree that would be inappropriate in terms of, you know, relitigating at the council the work that was done in terms of the discussions, in terms of the work towards consensus. But in this particular case, it's simply recognizing that it was out of scope for the group and that it really should be referred to the group that has the responsibility for reviewing existing RPMs and existing consensus policy of UDRP. So sorry for going on so long, but that's my sense. And if anybody else would like to jump in on that, feel free to do so. Marie, you're next.
Thanks, Keith. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Great. With all the audio issues we have, this is Marie. I would like to thank you for your mail this morning and also for your explanation right now. As you know, this is a concern that I raised back in, I think it was in Los Angeles, but maybe before. It is a very specific question. It's a very technical question. It's a very complex question. So I'm talking about recommendation 5, sorry, a narrow group that can look at this, and so it doesn't fall into the, for want of a better word, melee that is the current RPM with all the work going on there. I'm really supportive of that on a personal level, so I would like to thank you for understanding. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Marie. I think as we talk about next steps, I agree that simply handing this issue to the entire RPM PDP working group at this current stage of its work, which is already behind schedule, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, I think handing it to them would be a mistake if it was simply saying, okay, here, PDP working group, RPM PDP working group, take this on and go figure it out, right? I think that what we can do as the council is to apply some of our PDP 3.0 guidelines and sort of the work that's been done there, create a small team within the RPM PDP working group. And again, part of the reason we want to, I think, have it within an existing PDP that's focusing on the issue from recommendation number 5 is also we've got a broad group of people participating, right? And I'm concerned that if we were to go the ePDP route, which I don't think we have support for, we'd need a supermajority support to do that from council, is that, you know, you basically have a broad group and then have a very focused element within that group, rather than having to try to find people who care about this issue and are interested in this issue sufficiently to participate in a standalone ePDP. I'm really concerned that we simply wouldn't be able to find enough people that care to participate in a new standalone PDP. So that's sort of, again, sort of the further thinking and the further rationale for, you know, housing this effort within the RPM group, but having it be, a really focused and targeted subset that can work on its own timelines and, you know, maybe not be held back by the broader work of the group. So anyway, sorry for going on so long there. Marie, I think that's your old hand, and then Martin.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yep, sure can.
Perfect. I just want to echo what both of you guys were saying. And to remember, not like a mantra, but to remember that right protection mechanism is a review working group, and it's supposed to say, okay, this process is working or it's not working because this data showed us that, and we recommend we adjust it with this way. And that's a very different task than creating a mechanism from scratch, which is sort of what the recommendation 5 is trying to do. So, again, repeating what you guys said regarding the timeline and everything, it comes to the core of, it's not just about throwing it to phase 2 where we can, you know, sort it out there or redo the chart there. I like the idea of having a small team that sort of is eventually evaluated by the RPM working group that has this independent, you know, life where it just doesn't compete, doesn't stall, doesn't go into the work of phase 2. When we refer to phase 2, we're just referring to a timeline. We're not referring to the actual phase 2 moment because as it is now, the working group is just not charted to take this task. And it's not a matter of just adjusting 2 or 3 words. The working group was not prepared to create mechanisms. It was just prepared to have a data-driven review that implies small connections, small adjustments, not whole redoing of it. So just to echo it, and the counselors are maybe not so familiarized with it, have a deeper understanding that when we say we are throwing this to phase 2, we have to be very conscious that it is not about just inserting it to phase 2. But in the wildest scenario, it just means that it will somehow relate to their RPM work in a later stage. Thanks.
Yes, thanks very much, Martin. And, I think you make some really good points there, and I also think that, you know, while we need to make sure that the group, any subgroup is very narrowly focused, we want to make sure it's not too narrowly focused in that, you know, the group needs to be able to, you know, sort of consider the implications of jurisdictional immunity that the IGOs have, and is that specific to, trademark issues or is it something else? I mean, and I'm getting way out over my skis here in terms of the substance, but I think we'll need to be very, very careful and cautious, I think, Martin, to your point, about how we go through the chartering and to make sure we get it right. Because I think at that point, we will be, you know, either setting up the subgroup to succeed or to fail. I see, Martin, yeah, you're saying not just for, you know, the subgroup, but making it clear what the RPM working group is. And I think we certainly have an opportunity to look at rechartering that group as a whole to make sure that it's as specific as it needs to be. So by all means, Carlos, over to you.
Sorry, this is Carlos. I had a hard time finding the button. Just a follow-up. Very straightforward, as simple as possible. Could a narrowly chartered subgroup of RPM deal with issues like a protection list similar to the Red Cross case? Yes or no? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carlos. I don't see why it couldn't consider it. I would have to. I don't know if it applies directly to this particular issue or not, frankly, on substance. It's a great question. If anybody else has an answer, Mary, if you have an answer as to whether that would be, a possible avenue for consideration, but I don't think we would necessarily tie their hands if there are a range of options to consider. So, Mary, go ahead and respond. Thank you. And then I'm going to go to Rafiq and then Martin again.
Thanks, Keith. Just real quick, as a procedural reminder, the Curative Rights Working Group scope in terms of a list of IGOs actually started with the list of IGOs from the GAC, which at the moment is 192. About a year into its work, the working group actually requested the council at the time, I think it was 2015, to amend its charter to broaden it to all eligible IGOs. So at the moment, what you're dealing with in terms of recommendation 5 is a broader scope, a wider list, not even an enumerated list, compared to the GAC list of 192. But as Keith said, that doesn't mean that if the new group were to be scoped in a particular way, or even if the new group, as it goes about its business, figures that the most appropriate legal and policy rationale might be for a more limited group based on, you know, a law or good policy making, that they couldn't do that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mary. And I hope that answers your question, Carlos. So I'll go to Rafiq next, and then Martin, and then we probably need to move on and move to a vote. So, Rafiq?
Thanks, Keith. That was really a short intervention. Good to hear all the comments and the input about, possible ways to do in the future. So I think we have the flexibility when the council will start, decide how we do the recommendation number 5, and the motion give us that ability. So we are kind of, when the time is there, we are already taking the note of what was proposed and like the small team and so on, and we can elaborate that in due time. So I think it's really good. We should move on, and I think we have that flexibility to deal with the issue later on. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Rafiq. Martin, you have the last word.
Yes, just a very quick follow-up. Is that, of course, we're going to have to touch something of the charter to have recommendation 5 to the RPM, but my personal view is that we shouldn't touch what phase 2 already is, because basically that's how it was chartered to work for UDRP review. If you're going to add something, you can call it phase 3, you can call it parallel, board track, whatever, but I wouldn't try to just plug it in phase 2, because any review of phase 2 chart part is going to be very, 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 very messy. And it's going to bring a lot of delays. So, our work in taking recommendation 5 inside the working group should not disrupt in any way the already phase 2 work that is coming up. I don't know if that's clear enough, but that work track should not be altered. Whatever we do, the work group might be a good place to do recommendation 5, but the phase 2 should keep running as it is, because it's not, we are opening a Pandora box.
Okay. Thanks, Martin. And I take your point. And I think here what we have is a situation where recommendation number 5 is suggesting or recommending changes to the UDRP, which is, of course, the main focus of phase 2. But I think as we look to charter a subteam or a separate work track, however we decide to do that, I think it's possible that the work of that group will not be on recommendation number 5, or sort of the proposed change to the UDRP. It could actually focus on something else, but eventually it will still be one of the rights protection mechanisms one way or the other, and so I take your point, though, that that it could end up having some implication for phase 2, but it could also sort of carve its own path, I think. So with that, thank you, Martin, and you could put your hand down. Thank you. So I think, sort of my last comment on this before we move to a vote is that this is obviously a sensitive subject. Not all of us agree on everything, and I appreciate everybody's focus and time on a subject that is rather complex and, legal and not something that we necessarily follow on a day-to-day basis. So I think the key here will be proper communication of our discussion and of our deliberations to the GAC and to the ICANN board. So I think that that will be an action item, following this decision, following this vote, that basically, indicates how we've come to see this and how we hoped that there is a constructive path forward where interested parties among the IGOs and the GAC will be able to participate, and where it will be focused and where there will be timeframes associated with it that ensure, a timely delivery and a timely conclusion, where we want all interested parties to be able to contribute, and that, we're not kicking the can down the road, we're not burying it, and we're certainly not approving all 5 recommendations, that we're signaling that this is something where we recognize some additional work needs to be done, and that we're doing the best that we can within our GNSO processes and procedures to make that happen. I have an action item to ensure that we develop that appropriate communication, and of course that will be circulated to everybody before we send it. So with that, unless there are any other questions, comments, I'm going to hand it over to Natalie for the vote.
Thank you, Keith. This is Natalie. Just to confirm, would you like a voice vote or a roll call vote?
I'm fine with let's do the roll call vote.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much. We'll proceed with the roll call vote. Martin Silva-Valens, proxy for Arsene Tsangali.
Aye.
Martin Silva-Valens for yourself. Thank you. Pam Little?
Yes.
Marie Petullo?
Yes.
Thank you. Aidan Federline for El Sassadi?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Aidan Federline for yourself?
Yes. Thanks again.
Thank you. Maxime Alfilber?
Yes.
Thank you. Osvaldo Novella?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Sayed Ismail Shah?
Thank you.
Sorry, Sayed Ismail Shah?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Carlos Gutierrez?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Scott McCormick?
Yes.
Keith Drazik?
Yes.
Darcy Sudwell?
Yes.
Tatiana Tropina?
Aye.
Thank you. Flick Petillon?
No.
Philippe, would you care to mention the reasons for your objection, please?
I refer to the reasons we've given before. It's 1-5, all in one package, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Philippe. Michael and Alan?
Yes.
Rubens Cole?
Yes.
Paul McGrady?
No.
Thank you, Paul. Would you like to expand on the reasons for your objection?
Yes, thank you. So, again, this is Paul McGrady for the record. First of all, the IPC would like to thank those members of this working group who acted in good faith and tried really hard to get something across the finish line. However, looking at the history of this particular working group, it's pretty clear that the process was broken. And even the co-chairs, I believe, indicated that they thought there were significant issues with regard to the process. We just think that it's dangerous to vote even for 1-4, which have various levels of innocuousness, when it could be viewed as rewarding those who were involved perhaps in disrupting the process of the working group. We also don't think that this really got to the heart of the need that was raised by the GAC in the first place. So both procedurally and on the substance, we think this is one that should not, shouldn't go any further. So that is why the IPC is voting no. That is not in any way to, as I said, detract from those who engaged in good faith in this particular working group, and we do not vote no lightly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Philippe Foucault, please.
Yes.
Thank you very much. For the contracted party house, we have 7 votes in favor, no votes against, and no abstention. For the non-contracted party house, we have 11 votes in favor, 2 against, and no abstention. The motion passes over 100% for the contracted party house and 84.62% in the non-contracted party house. Thank you. Over to you, Keith.
Thank you very much, Natalie, and thanks to everybody for, again, your patience and for your willingness to engage on this. And Paul and Flip, I should say, from the IPC perspective, I completely understand your view. That's exactly why we, conduct the votes and have the opportunity to, sort of explain the rationale. So thank you very much for participating in this. And as I said, this was a difficult one, and this one where there was no perfect answer. I'd just like to thank everybody for your continued engagement, because this one, while we've come to a decision now, as I noted before, the board could take our recommendations 1-4 and accept them, or they could reject them. They could send them back to us. And we, of course, still have the work to do on recommendation number 5, the chartering of the small group, the integration, to the extent necessary with the RPM-PDP working group. So this issue is far from over. And, of course, there will be some ruffled feathers, some unhappiness among our GAC colleagues that we'll need to manage carefully. I think they were hopeful that we were, looking to do, a standalone EPDP and not approve anything. I can understand that desire, but I think this is the compromise that we were able to end up with as it relates to, following our own procedures and recognizing that, we can do better moving forward with our PDP 3.0 work in terms of managing processes. Thanks. So with that, and in the interest of time, we need to move to the next item on our agenda, which is a council discussion on managing IDM variant TLDs. So with that, I'm going to thank Sarmad for joining us. Thank you for your patience, Sarmad, as we worked through some delicate issues there. But let me hand it over to you then for a discussion on the managing IDM variant TLDs. I think as everybody remembers, the ICANN board passed some resolutions at its board meeting in Kobe related to this topic. Let me just hand it over to Sarmad. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Can you all hear me clearly?
Yep, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
Excellent. So thank you for inviting me to introduce the work on IDN variant TLD implementation. Next slide, please. The main focus of this presentation is to, first of all, understand what IDN variant TLDs are and understand the status of where we are with IDN variant TLDs. I will, based on the resolution from the board, I will list possible next steps GNSO could take. Before we go into the IDN variant TLDs, I was asked to give a very brief introduction to the bigger picture on how different pieces of IDN work fit together. So we'll start from there, and then we'll come back to the variant TLDs. So next slide, please. So basically, IDN, can we adjust the size so that we fit in the presentation? Thank you. As far as the big picture is concerned, IDN top-level domains, as you understand, means that the domain names are in, IDN domain names basically mean that domain names are in a script which is beyond, or language which is beyond the regular addresses we see, which are comprised of letters, digits, and hyphen from ASCII characters. Basic IDN standard is based on what is a Unicode standard, which encodes all the scripts of the world. And you can see that their current version, or Unicode 11 version, encodes 146 scripts and 137,000 characters. The standard for internationalized domain names is based on the work on IE by Internet Engineering Task Force, which developed the IDNA 2008 standard, which shortlists these characters and tells us which characters can be used in domain names for the internationalized domain names. And they use a formula, so to speak, on Unicode, which shortlists the characters to about 900,000, or exactly 97,973 characters and 145 scripts. And the way it's shortlists these is that it excludes symbols like emoji and punctuation marks like semicolon and parentheses. So those are not allowed in domain names. But what is allowed is digits and letters and many scripts, including old scripts like hieroglyphic scripts. The IDNA 2008 standard is applied, the standard itself notes that it is still a very liberal shortlist, and each registry or zone operator should restrict the characters further and possibly use variant techniques to ensure that the IDNs can be used securely and in a stable manner. Next slide, please. For the second level domains, the shortlist of these characters is done by the registry operator, which is managing the appropriate top level domain. And that is normally done through the mechanism we call the IDN tables. So a registry operator would develop multiple IDN tables for the languages and scripts they want to support, and that obviously then is used to offer the second level domains for registration. In addition, we have IDN guidelines which are applied in that process, and these guidelines are basically focused on enabling a secure use of second level domain names, and specifically to reduce consumer confusion as far as second level domain names are concerned. Next slide, please. In addition, we also need a similar IDN table for could we go back to the previous slide, please? Oops. Next slide. Yeah, thank you. So for the root zone or for the top level, we also need this shortlisting of characters, and the characters are further shortlisted, as you can see, for top-level domains, where the number of scripts are sharp, reduced to about 28 scripts we are doing at this time, and number of characters reduced from 100,000 to about 33,000. This excludes old scripts like Egyptian hieroglyphics. This excludes digits because digits are not used at top level, and so on. So based on the what we call the MSR or maximal starting repertoire, we are working with the community to define the shortlisted characters and variants which are possible for the root zone. That is normally referred to as the root zone label generation rules, which we are currently working on with the communities. And then those will eventually be used or are proposed to be used for the top-level domains. While in this process, the IDN variant TLD recommendations are proposed for the GNSO and CCNSO to be considered. So this is the larger context of the work. Today we will be talking specifically on IDN variant TLD recommendations. Next slide, please. So when we're defining TLDs or when we're realizing TLDs, community has very early indicated that there may be multiple labels which could be considered the same by the community. And as you can see on the screen, there is at least a security issue which needs to be resolved by identifying these same labels which we call variants. The example at the top gives you a Latin label .epic, but you can see that we have a Cyrillic label which looks exactly the same. So obviously such labels must be identified and blocked at least. But in case of Chinese, which are visually not identical, but they mean the same thing. So in the case of Chinese, you can have simplified versus traditional Chinese, and we need both of them not only reserved for the same applicant, but also delegated and activated, because we need both variations for users to access these domain top-level domains. And the reason is that simplified Chinese is used in mainland China, whereas the more traditional Chinese, which is the label at the bottom, is used in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and certain other areas. So to have access from across the different geographical spread, both versions need to be activated. Similar is the case for Arabic script, where different versions of label actually need to be used at the same time to access the label from across different regions globally. So there is a security angle for variant TLDs, but also usability for at least two scripts, the Chinese script and the Arabic script. Next slide, please. And in our analysis, we've seen for the 28 scripts we are currently working on that variants, at least from a security perspective, are not something which is very unique to one or two or three scripts. We've seen within script or cross script variants for many of the scripts we are currently working on. So it is something which obviously has to be realized. Next slide, please. Can we go back to the So very early on, the community had requested for variant ELDs, but in 2010, the board has said that we don't understand variant ELDs, so they should not be delegated at this time, and ask the community to do more work. The slides are moving. Could we go back? Basically, the board had said the community should work on identifying what are the problems and how to solve problems around IDN variant ELDs to solve them or resolve them. So there were two problems identified. First, there was no consistent definition of variant ELDs at that time in 2010. And then there was, even if we knew what variant ELDs were, there were no management mechanisms for them. Next slide, please. To define the variant code points, as I just shared, we are currently working with the community to define the root zone LGR. We've identified 28 scripts which cover most of the commonly used languages in the first phase, and currently we've finalized 19 of the 28 proposals for 19 of the 28 scripts, and this work continues, and a root zone LGR is incrementally being finalized. Next slide, please. So that root zone LGR solves the first question, which is how to define variant labels. The second question which was raised was, once these are defined, how do we manage variant labels? And that was the work which we've actually done internally within ICANN for some years, and have developed some recommendations on how to manage them. These are based on some of the work which is already done by the community, and also the existing processes within analyzing the existing processes within by CCNSO through fast track process, and GNSO through the applicant guidebook for the new GTLD round. Next slide, please. So this work actually took a bit of time to develop. This is just a summary of just internal work. This was being directly supervised by the board IDN working group. They were looking at the work which was being done, and eventually the recommendations which were finalized were released for public comment in summer of last year. Next slide, please. Based on the public feedback which was received, we've incorporated that and updated the IDN variant ELD recommendations, and they were then published as a set of six documents in February of this year. And in the Kobe meeting in March, the ICANN board approved these recommendations and requested GNSO and CCNSO to take these into account in their policy development as they move forward, see if they can if they can do that in a manner consistent across the CCNSO and GNSO, because eventually these guidelines apply to both CCTLDs and GTLDs, because both of them are TLDs. So there is some consistency which is desired. Next slide, please. So as far as next steps are concerned, we have the nine recommendations which are out. In addition, we've actually done analysis and impact on various, the application process for TLDs, the delegation process, and the operations. That analysis is also presented in the reports which are published. We've also published some associated materials, for example, the rationale for why root zone label generation rules should be used, and there's some other documents. So these are all presented to CCNSO and GNSO for their consideration and further policy development process. Again, as I said, GNSO and CCNSO are being requested by the board to see if they could look into how this could be done in a way that it is consistent across the two SOs. So thank you very much. Stop here and take any questions.
Thank you very much, Sarmad. This is Keith, and thank you for the level of detail and being able to get through it as quickly as you did. So thanks for that. I see Maxim has his hand up and Rubens has his hand up, so I'll go directly to them. Maxim?
Maxim Ozoba for the transcript. I have a question. What happens to IDN tables for the current TLDs which were approved by IANA? And actually, during the conversations with GDD, yeah, it was promised that those are going to be like legacy and not going to be touched and going to be valid. Okay. Is it going to be changed? It's the first question. And the second is, historically, a similarity between 1 and small l, 0 and small or capital O, caused way more trouble than hypothetical issues with IDNs. Were there any investigation of the persons of hypothetical damage from IDNs and those quite, I'd say, few decades old issues with those digits and letters? Thanks. In English, ASCII script. Thanks.
Right. So if you could, we could go to slide 4, I think. Sorry, the next one. Yeah. So as far as the IDN tables are concerned, those are relevant for the second level domains. I guess the current focus of the presentation was on the top level, so that's the IDN tables in a way are the top level domains don't focus directly on the IDN tables, which are for the second level. But just answering your questions, the IDN tables which are currently approved will obviously are already approved and they already apply. So I think moving forward, unless there is some changes proposed where they need to be reevaluated new tables are added when they are evaluated, the current IDN tables obviously continue to apply.
Thank you very much, Sarmad, and thanks, Maxim. And in the interest of time, we probably need to move on. We've got one more agenda item that we need to get to, but I want to get to Rubens next. And Maxim, if there's further follow-up questions or reaction, we probably ought to, you know, pull together a small group of counsel with expertise and an interest in this to continue coming up with questions and to engage with ICANN. So Rubens, over to you.
Thanks, Keith. Something that has been noticed by the registries looking into this question is that even though the guidelines sometimes mentioned as IDN guidelines, sometimes mentioned as IDN implementation guidelines, they are pretty much like policy in defining obligations. So the walk-like policy, the quack-like policy, and so they are probably going to require policy efforts from both GNSO and CCNSO, according to their own procedures. The various LD recommendations include some recommendations to amend policies like UGRP, TMCH, PDDRP, which are being looked into a current PDP, RPM. They also go into subject matter for the next round of TRDs, which is part of sub-pro PDP. So while they are sometimes mentioned as implementation, what their actual substance looks more like policy and more like something for both organizations, GNSO and CCNO, to look into. And interest of time, let's stop there. There are some more minutiae I would like to go into, but there is no time. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Rubens. I'm sorry if I missed it. Was there a question for Sarmad? And Sarmad, did you have any response or reaction?
I'll just make a short comment. So as the question was again on IDN guidelines, I guess, and not on the IDN variant TLD recommendations. So as far as the IDN guidelines are concerned, these are developed by the community. Basically revised. They're focused on reducing consumer confusion, and they're revised from time to time on the request of the community. And they are recently being revised based on a request from GNSO back in the London meeting at ICANN 50. There was some work done by recently by the community. There was a working group which had members from GNSO, CCNSO, and also ALAC and ASAC, which looked at these guidelines which are currently applicable and did an updated version recently, which is currently being considered. So IDN guidelines pertain to consumer confusion, and they are developed by the community, and then use those guidelines for reviewing. Those are eventually implemented based on community feedback.
Thanks very much, Sarmad, and thank you, Maxim and Rubens, for the questions and the good discussion here. But in the interest of time, we need to move on. So, Sarmad, I'd like to thank you for your participation here today. And this is really, for everybody's benefit, just the beginning of this conversation on IDN variants. I know that this is really technical and really complex, and it doesn't always apply to every one of us. But we do have a developing situation where, you know, new rules related to IDNs, guidelines are being developed and implemented, and contracted parties are taking on new obligations outside of a typical PDP. And we do have this new information from the board on IDN variants at the top level and the need to coordinate with the CCNSO. And there's just a lot of moving parts here. And we as a council are going to need to take a look at this this topic of IDN variants, I think, a bit more holistically moving forward. With that, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Sarmad, and we'll go ahead and move on to the last item on our agenda. So if everybody can please bear with us for another 10 minutes and no more, and we will receive an update from Russ Weinstein on the ongoing work of the ePDP temp spec phase one informal implementation review team. I covered some of this in my email to everybody, but I'd like to get a quick readout, 5 or 10 minutes, no more, with Russ. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Keith. This is Russ Weinstein from ICANN, and thank you for having me today. I'm pinch hitting for Dennis Chang, who usually will give these updates, I believe, as needed. He's our leader on our internal implementation team. So we've established our what we call our implementation project team. It's a cross-functional team we do for all policy implementations. In this case, it includes those staff members that participated in the EPDP, plus the others that typically get into policy implementations, representatives from GDD, compliance, legal, technical services, and so on. We've been reviewing the recommendations. It's a big package of work, trying to define what the required deliverables are and creating the implementation plan. We do note that the recommended effective date of the policy is 29 February 2020 and are developing work back plans accordingly to try and fit that date. As you probably all know, this is a new feature in policy recommendations, putting a target date in the policy recommendations, and we're still assessing the feasibility of this date, but we're doing what we can to align to it. Also, in accordance with the final report's recommendation, we've initiated a call for volunteers for an informal implementation review team. I think we're calling it a pre-IRT. As you know, we typically don't establish IRTs until after board adoption of policy recommendations, but based on the special circumstance and the request from the council here, we're doing so. That pre-IRT work is intended to focus on clarifications. It's especially helpful that the bulk of the membership comes from the PDP team, and so clarifying things to this IPT team at ICANN. You may have seen a recent email from Dennis to the council asking if you'd like a council liaison on this pre-IRT. We know there's a feature of regular IRTs, and we don't think it's mandatory, but wanted to give you the opportunity. The pre-IRT assembled thus far is comprised of 12 community members with affiliations in RYSG, RRSG, IPC, BC, NCSG, and SAC, and all members were part of the EPDP Phase 1 working group. There's also an observer email group for the pre-IRT, and they have the read-only access, and that list is growing. It's already up around 28, 30 members or so. We had a kickoff meeting a week or so ago on the 10th of April, and the team agreed to meet every couple weeks on Wednesdays to support the ICANN team preparing the policy implementation. Those are the main points I wanted to share with you all, but I'm here for questions as necessary.
Thanks very much, Russ, and appreciate you being here, as you said, pinch hitting for Dennis, but thanks for the update. And let me just see if anybody has any questions or comments. We did forward the note that we received from ICANN about the any volunteers for a council liaison. We have not had anybody step up yet, but we'll keep after that and advise if we decide that it's something that we'd like to have. So any questions or comments for Russ? Okay. I don't see any hands, Russ. So thanks very much then for the update, and we'll look forward to ongoing and further engagement on this, particularly as we move from the informal phase to the formal phase of the IRT following the board's approval of the phase one recommendations. So thanks again for joining. And with that, thanks, Russ. I'm going to move to the very last item on the agenda, which I will handle very quickly, which is an update on the timeline for the RPM-PDP working group. As I noted in my email, I hope everybody read it all the way down to the bottom, that in Kobe, the council leadership team, along with Paul McGrady, met with the co-chairs of the RPM-PDP working group. We basically indicated that we wanted to receive from the co-chairs, working with staff, an updated timeline with working methods and decision points, and to get a better and clearer picture as to how the group was going to move forward to deliver its phase one recommendations. And so we had given the co-chairs a target date of today. They have just requested, I guess last week, requested an extension, and we gave them an extension until the 26th of April. So we will have another update scheduled for our May meeting, which I believe is May 16th, and where we as the council will discuss and review an updated proposal from the co-chairs of the RPM group in terms of helping them to deliver and to drive forward on the phase one final report. So with that, any questions, any comments? We'll take the any other business to the list, but if anybody else has any, you know, final thoughts or final discussion points, feel free to put your hand up. And seeing none, with that, I will bring this meeting to a conclusion. So thanks to everybody for your participation and your patience in going 7 minutes over, and have a great rest of your day. Thanks all.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Operator, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.